Star Wars Action News presents Republic Forces Radio Network, bringing you coverage of Star Wars, The Clone Wars. Our hosts will review the toys, books, comics, games, and all things related to the Clone Wars animated series. And after each new episode airs on Cartoon Network, our hosts will recap and review the show. And we want to hear your thoughts on The Clone Wars. Call us at 415-508-JEDI every Saturday after a new episode, and your call may be played on the air.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Republic Forces Radio Network. Here to discuss all things Star Wars animation, and we are back to discuss this week's episode of The Clone Wars Bounty. And you know what's...
Yes, right here. Oh, sorry, right. Gotta keep doing that.
Exactly what I was going to say. It's kind of fitting that for Bounty, here to discuss Bounty is Bounty. Fitting.
Hey, guys. Jerry here, and very interested to discuss this episode and complete what I think is an arc within itself before we get to the real arc that we wanted to see all along when we were watching the four-part arc that's really a two-part arc before the two-part arc with Darth Maul. Wow.
Exactly.
That just felt like the verse from that I'm My Own Grandpa song. There was some very confusing twists and turns in there, Jerry. But also joining us, as you may have heard, is from Star Wars Action News, Marvelicious Toys, and now playing Arnie.
Happy to be here, Dan.
And last but not least, from Star Wars Fanworks, Nathan P. Butler.
Hello all, good to be back.
All right, and we are going to be discussing Episode 20, Bounty. And before we get going with our discussion of the events of the episode, let's go around. And we kind of got a little bit of a tease out of Jerry already, but let's see what we all thought of this week's episode. And we'll let Jerry finish his thought.
I know why the show is called Bounty. It's not because they're bounty hunters and they're on a bounty. It's because it's what Dengar's head's obviously wrapped with. I never put that together before. He uses the strongest, most absorbent paper towel in the galaxy to secure his head. Because, you know, what if he gets a wound? Boom, absorbent material. So it's all making sense now. No, obviously just kidding. I loved this episode. I pretended halfway through the episode that I wasn't watching The Clone Wars. I was watching the series premiere of this cool Star Wars animated series called The Bounty Hunters Guild, and I loved every minute of it.
All right, Arnie, what did you think?
I was with Jerry for, I'd say, the first third of the episode, and then it just kind of devolved for me, and we'll get into it, but I wasn't as enthused this week as I was last, but this felt like filler to me. I was afraid of it. Last week, I was like, I'm scared this is going to be filler. And about a third of the way in, I'm like, this is filler, but good filler. And then it all went to crap. So we'll talk about it as we go, but I'm fairly lukewarm on this.
All right. And Nathan P.
You know, usually what I find is that when I watch one of these episodes, the first impression is really good, and then I get more critical the second time around. This time, I guess, kind of worked in reverse. The first time I was watching it, I sort of felt like Arnie was saying, where it sort of felt like, oh, it's a filler episode. They're on this random mission on this random planet. Doesn't really mean much of anything. But in seeing some of the groundwork that's been laid here, you know, the rivalry perhaps now between Boba Fett and Ventress and the connection with these bounty hunters, and just that, in my opinion, very unexpected twist on how Ventress leaves the story, it started to feel more like, well, maybe it's sort of a filler story, but it's a necessary thing to lay that groundwork. But if that's the case, did they do a good job of giving us a story that lays it? And then I turn around and watch it a second time, and with that very different perspective of, did they do a good job giving us a story that's entertaining while laying out those points, kind of like a first season Babylon 5 kind of episode, I really, really enjoyed it the second time around, especially with new improvements like Ventress's face. It seemed like it's better animated. I think this actually may be in my top 10, at least definitely within the top 15 of the whole series now, which I wouldn't have expected on first viewing. The second one was the charm this time around.
All right. And, you know, I really found myself enjoying this episode. I was afraid it was just going to be junk filler, but I kind of like the way they sort of rounded out Asajj Ventress's story here. And honestly, were she to kind of fade into the background for the rest of the series, I'd kind of be okay with how they've left her. Was it the greatest episode ever? Well, yeah, it had all the bounty hunters in it. Duh. I mean, no, it was a good, solid episode for me. was it necessary for this arc? Maybe to see where she goes, not necessarily to get us to where we're going to be for the final two. But all in all, I didn't feel like, oh, why the heck did they do this at the end? So I'm all right with it. So let's jump right in.
Now, we normally just mention the fortune cookie, but this week I actually have to take issue with the fortune cookie. I'm really thinking it's sending a bad message because it says, who we are never changes, who we think we are does. I think that that is a terrible, fatalistic message. I think it's just disheartening to people of all ages. I mean, if you're a kid and you're watching this show, what's this telling you? People never change. So that bully on the playground, he's always going to beat you up. I completely disagree with this as a opening fortune cookie.
Arnie, I gave up on fortune cookies a long time ago, even making sense to the episodes. In fact, I mean, I don't know, to Dan's point, where Asajj Ventress is going to be found later in the series, but I kind of felt like she took a change, you know, not just in who she thought she was, but it almost seemed like she was finding some peace or some like character development here of, hey, you know what, I've been other people's tools and weapons, and now I'm ready to be something else. I think it was just a complete opposite.
So it wasn't the characters of the Clone Wars speaking as a group about the continuity of the Clone Wars and how it keeps changing? That wasn't a message to Lucas or anything?
I honestly wonder, truthfully, if the person who wrote it understands the words they wrote. Maybe because I agree with you, Jerry. It seems to me like Ventress does change in this episode. Is the cookie telling us that you're going to think Ventress changes in this episode, but later you're going to find out, oh, only her opinion of herself changes because she's always going to be evil harpy?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. You do wonder if they meant to, like, the person who wrote it saw that was like, oh, crap. No. I meant you can change who you are even if people don't. Oh, crap. I messed it up.
I wonder if part of it is the idea that Ventress has always been defined by people other than herself. You know, even last episode, right? It was, you know, you will never take orders again except from us, basically, is what Talzin is saying. And between the time that she's with her former Jedi Master, at least briefly, she spends time trying to become Dooku's Sith Apprentice. She spends time, at least a brief amount of time, trying to go back into the Night Sisters. It's sort of like she's always defined by something outside of herself. Maybe what they're getting at is the idea that who she is, who she really is, on the inside, hasn't ever changed, but her perceptions of what she wants to be or what she should be has always been defined by who she is around. And now that she is actually independent, the real Asajj Ventress can come out. Maybe that's what they're getting at, but it's an incredibly clumsy way of trying to get at that if that's what they were trying to say with the fortune cookie.
Yeah, I'm with Jerry. I kind of gave up on the fortune cookies a while ago because this one is a little bit strange. Are we saying that deep down Asajj always was this kind of ho-hum, slink off into the background character, but she didn't realize that until she saved a lady in a box? Very strange. So, a bald chick walks into a bar.
Is this the bar, Nathan?
Apparently so. At least that's what it appears to be from the way it's being played out within any of the official stuff that I've seen. I haven't seen them make a big deal out of it, but it appears to be.
Yeah, I thought that's kind of what they were trying to go with, that she was walking into the Mos Eisley Cantina, because I guess that's the only place that everybody falls back on is the Mos Eisley Cantina. There's, of all the, you know, Corellian whiskey joints and all the worlds.
Well, you know, that is like the Cheers of the Star Wars universe, right? She walks in, everyone's like, Asajj!
Then she gnocks a guy for offering to buy her a drink. What's up with that?
Am I the only one when she did that had to go back and play it again in slow motion to figure out where she stabbed him? I honestly thought that they had gone so far based on the way that her hand is moving at first that she had put it up against a certain part you wouldn't want cut and that it had stabbed out of another certain part you really wouldn't want cut. I had to go back in slow motion to see that, yes, it went through his lower stomach. That was it. It really kind of cracked me up and freaked me out when I saw it.
I'm going to say I don't want my lower stomach cut like that either.
Well, you know, relatively speaking, though, you know.
Yeah, Nathan, can you tell me where you would want cut? I'm kind of curious about that.
Nathan, show me on the doll where you want it to cut you.
It would be funny if he hadn't died. He just said, hey, thanks for the vasectomy.
So after Asajj puts down her would-be suitor, she's informed that he was a member of a team of bounty hunters assembled by Bossk, and now she's got to fill the spot, because that's what you want, somebody who randomly sabers people through the midsection. You're going to fill in.
Yeah, it's like the Santa Claus or something, the Tim Allen movie, right? I mean, as much as I enjoyed this episode, this premise was dumb. Unless it was just one of those things like, well, hey, I didn't really like the guy. I was just assembling a team of people, and you seem pretty skilled, so hey, you're in. What I thought was really stupid was, hey, either join us and do this job, and we'll give you a cut, or we'll turn you into the police. Because, you know, we're like reputable citizens who turn people into the police.
Well, yeah, but they're on Tatooine, so the authorities wouldn't necessarily mean the police. The authorities could have just meant the Hutts at this point.
Well, I said police in place of authorities, but really? You know, threatening to rat someone out? Come on.
I had the same thought, but what I'm really coming down to is after what she did to their compatriot, they couldn't make her go. You can't blackmail her. We see later this episode what happens when a bounty hunter tries to exert their power over someone, which is what I said last week Ventra should have done to Grievous. So I think she had no place better to go, you know? Why not just go along? She had to have wanted to. She had to have just been curious or wanted a paycheck or had nothing better to do that day, because I don't think that that idle threat really was the motivator.
They play out sort of her thought process on her face here, and I really got to hand it to the team. I don't know if this is a new head model for the character or what they did, but it seems like she is way more expressive in this episode than she ever has been before, especially the little subtle twitches of the mouth and stuff like that. And you could sort of see her going through the bemused, oh yeah, really, kind of mindset as they're going through this, you know, well, you need to join us now. Broadly speaking, though, I mean, that's kind of something that we've seen before, sort of a storytelling cliche to say, okay, you know, now you've done something that harmed our mission as bounty hunters or as criminals or whatever. Now you've got to be brought in on it. You've got to take that person's place. It's not particularly logical, but it's something that's certainly not new to this story. It's a trope that's been used a lot, especially in things like Star Wars RPG adventures, as a hook to bring characters into scenarios.
You know, the one thing that this scene reminded me was, and no offense to Dee Bradley Baker, he does a great job usually with the clones and the various commander voices. I hate me some Bossk voice. I don't even have a problem with the fact that he speaks basic. I just do not like the voice that they have given him.
Because it's hard on the ears, or because it doesn't match the way you would expect Bossk to sound?
Because I don't think it sounds anything like I would expect. I mean, what we hear from an Empire, obviously, isn't basic, but it's kind of a guttural, not a lispy, wussy lizard voice like Bossk kind of has. He sounds more like an alien. And
Dan, I understand what you're saying about Bossk's voice. I've actually accepted it. The one that I didn't see coming was Dengar's voice.
Simon Pegg?
Except for the fact we saw it in the preview last week, but it was still too gentleman spy to me. But yeah, Simon Pegg, of course, yes.
I'm just so glad that they didn't cater to the masses, was pandering to the base, and have him say something like, you got some red on you.
I actually would have preferred that, because as it is, he adopted a Cockney accent, and if I didn't know going in it was him, I wouldn't have been able to tell.
You know, the way that his voice plays out, I mean, we might expect him to be a little more gruff because of the way that he looks by the time of Empire, but he's gone through a lot more stuff, more cybernetics, he's gone through the swoop crash and that sort of thing. So at least from an EU perspective, they've got plenty of reasons for him to come off more gruff later than he is now. What I find, and what a lot of folks apparently have found surprising, was that Simon Pegg came in and decided to do a voice for Clone Wars. As I'll mention in Continuity Corner, I mean, this is a guy who basically bashed the prequels like crazy, and then now he's like, ooh, I get a chance to play a part? Whee! Except apparently since then he said, just because I'm playing Dengar doesn't mean I like the prequels. Like, really? You know, pick a side of the issue, please, one way or the other.
Well, yeah. I can reconcile that because he's playing an original trilogy character in a basically something that's not a prequel movie. It's, you know, I mean, heck, the theme of the show, Bounty Hunters, this seems more original trilogy-ish than anything we've seen with a cast of characters, Asajj Ventress aside.
But would he have played the role or a role had it not been that character or this episode that is, once again, our second of the entire series that is, I think Arnie referred to it as Republic-less this time around? Or was it just, hey, I get a chance to be on Clone Wars? Because if it was the latter, it seems like that's a little disingenuous given the, you know, some of the public statements and such. I mean, certainly he's certainly free to change his mind and that sort of thing. It struck a lot of fans as odd. There was more backlash I saw online to this casting than pretty much any other casting in Clone Wars. And I honestly hadn't even heard about it until right around the time the backlash started when it was announced he was going to be doing this voice. It just seems like a weird public relations move on his part to essentially bash, then take the job, then turn around and not really bash, but sort of defend his previous bashing right afterwards. Just an odd one.
Well, for a show that doesn't have a good history for using original trilogy characters well, bringing Simon Pegg in after all that, I don't know. There's just a whole cataclysm waiting to happen here, or a whole lot of meh. Kind of like Dengar was in this episode, really.
You didn't want to see Greedo show up and be using the grappling bow instead of Lats Razi here? I mean, maybe he was meant to be there, and they have avoided that one this time around.
I was just upset that he didn't have the robot chicken voice and was saying, hey, they say the hunt's in the bounty's in the hunt. When somebody disintegrate, get Dengar integrated. That would have been perfect. That would have been awesome.
And Breckenmeyer needs a job.
Booyah!
Yeah, I got nothing.
On the plus side, Dengar's the only character who seems age-appropriate in the original trilogy to appear in the Clone Wars as an adult. I just wish that they'd shown us him getting his head injury and not had the head bandages on immediately.
We know those aren't even bandages, according to the creative team behind the Clone Wars. According to them, they were always meant to be. And we know that sometimes that can mean different things in Lucas Land. But according to the Clone Wars team, they were always meant to be essentially a turban. So it's assumed to be a turban here. And later on, it's either a turban or they're going to have to find a way to sort of retcon the idea that maybe he had a turban and now it's like a turban slash bandage because of the EU head injury that may or may not still be allowed to exist if they just say, yeah, well, it's a turban, not an injury. But yeah, it's not supposed to be an injury here at all.
Yeah, when they say it's always been that, they mean from the moment that they thought of the idea of the episode.
You know, what we think we are never changes or some crazy crap like that.
Well, it doesn't matter what it started off being. He falls off a train. It's a head injury now.
Oh, no, he got up and it's just poo-doo.
Yeah, once again, using the episode one swearing. Nice.
That might have been their way of getting back to Simon Pegg by making him say something stupid from the prequels.
It did kind of make me laugh, though, that, you know, every time these characters are falling off the train, I mean, they survive, which is nice because we get these characters back and these are sort of well-designed characters. I'd love to see this bounty hunting group back again because I think they could play really well into the series. You know, split them up, keep them together, whatever. There's some cool character designs and the way they can now interact with Ventress, very, very nice. But at the same time, they're all falling off and they're all surviving. You know, I couldn't help but think of Cobra and their parachutes. You know what I mean?
But let's talk about these bounty hunters. Nathan brings them up. We get Bossk and we get Dengar and Boba Fett's back and he still doesn't have any hair. Apparently his hair grows very, very slowly. That was a side effect of the cloning process. Everything else stayed the same, but his hair grows twice as slow.
Well, you know, he had just gotten out of prison too and they probably kept it pretty well shaved. But I thought it was a little different and a little bit more filled in and you know, it looked like he was starting to resembling less a clone and more a young Django, which I thought was kind of an interesting take.
Now, here's a side note on Boba Fett. Nathan, maybe you can give me some backup on this. When he watched the episode, my eldest pointed out that the helmet that Boba Fett is wearing in this is the same helmet that an AWOL clone that is hunted down in one of the comics is wearing.
That didn't strike me at all. It may be, but that the helmet did not strike me as familiar at all.
Yeah, that helmet didn't catch me. The helmets of the guys in the caves, those struck me. But we'll get to that. We still have two more bounty hunters to talk about. We have two new bounty hunters, Lats Razi and her chainmail boa thing, and then C-21. Now, I liked that droid. His face was very familiar. I'm wanting to say something out of Gladiator 300.
The only thing he really reminded me of when watching it, you know, I like the little spinning blaster trick. You know, we'll try spinning. That's a good trick. He does his little spin around shooting trick, and I'm like, Death Blossom! And some people out there are going to be like, yep. And others like, what are you talking about?
Nice. So we've got our little band of bounty hunters together, and right away we've got a clashing between the bald kid and the bald chick. Maybe it's hair envy or who's wearing the bald better. Does it strike anybody else as odd that he is a carbon copy of Jango Fett? But really, Boba is in charge at, what, 12 and a half, 11, 13?
I just kind of figured that he probably were assumed to believe perhaps that he's had a lot of experience while he was out getting the respect of others, pulling off some bounties to be able to pull the group together. Or maybe he was the one that pulled them together from a financial standpoint, maybe some money that Jango had had. It's just kind of one of those things that it seems odd and awkward, but if he's meant to be the real rockin' bounty hunter he becomes later, it would make sense that he would start trying to gain stature fairly young. Or maybe he was the one that made the deal, because he makes the deal, he calls the shots, he's the one who divvies up the money at the end. It didn't seem quite as awkward to have him in charge than I think it would have been if it was the first time we'd seen him in the series and all of a sudden he's leading a band of bounty hunters. At least at this point, he's got some history with some of these characters. And, you know, we can sort of believe that maybe there's more to him. He has been in prison. You know, there's no teardrop tattoo or anything, but he has been in prison for a while. You know, he's hardened at this point, somewhat.
I still have expected a little bit more of being in somebody else's shadow and learning the ropes, like a Bosk or Dengar, or just the rest of the adult crew, and that he's learning as he goes, and that at some point he'll mature into, you know, a full grown adult, of course, and then, you know, prove to be the most cunning of them all and you know, gain some fame on his own. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, I don't remember, and I've read some of these stories, but I don't remember what their association is come Empire Strikes Back. I mean, obviously they're all on the Executor taking, you know, directions from Darth Vader, at least obviously Bosk and Dengar. But I don't remember if they're friendly or not. I vaguely recall that him and Dengar are, but I don't know, or is, you know, Nathan or somebody educate me, is Boba and Bosk like buddies in Empire Strikes Back? Or I thought there was more rivalry there, especially when they're going after, you know, Han in general.
Yeah, there's rivalry, but I mean, it's a good intervening two decades in between anyway, so a lot of stuff can change in that amount of time. I didn't really, you know, see anything weird about them working together here any more than the last time around.
Oh, no, that wasn't my point. My point was that perhaps they could be working together now well, and it's Boba learning the ropes, but then two decades later when we see him in Empire, yeah, Boba's become his own person. So I'm kind of like you, Dan. I found it odd that he's like the brains of the outfit already. I expect him to be there doing some good things and showing that he's going to become that bad mamma jamma down the road. But right now, that's a little odd, but I'm going to roll with it because we all know it's Boba Fett. I loved his little armor, though. I mean, he's carrying that helmet around. I'm thinking, oh, put that helmet on. I guess that's going to be cool. That's going to be really cool. And I think it'll make a really good action figure, too.
I'm right there with you, Jerry, on being surprised that he was already the head of the gang. But yeah, it is Boba Fett, so I'm willing to give it some leeway.
So our motley crew of bounty hunters takes the Houndsooth, which we kind of got teased with a couple weeks ago, but now we actually get to see it. And they arrive at the orbital station above Quarzite to meet their employer and get their assignment. And then they take the big elevator through the pressurized atmosphere to the train, where actually it's before this, they find out that they are escorting a box, and Boba Fett gets an order that he will get later if the EU stands in the Enemy of the Empire comic series, don't look in the box.
Now let me ask you, just on first seeing this box and hearing Rigoso saying, you know, about how there's this, you know, there's the resistance or whoever it is, whoever's against Otua Blank, the person he's sending it to, would try to stop them. That's why it needs to be guarded. Initially, I'm thinking either it's got to be something weird like a living being inside, which actually was an idea that I dismissed very quickly, or I was thinking that Rigoso, maybe he's working against whoever he's sending it to. He's actually part of that group that would want to be trying to get it, that he's supposedly warning them against. And maybe it was a bomb or something inside. I'll say, don't open the box, because it would explode. I'm expecting something to go boom. So the entire time I'm watching this box, wondering at what point somebody's going to jostle it the wrong way or knock it open, as happens later, and have it just explode or have a timer start going off or something like that. I was expecting it to be something dangerous in and of itself. Was I the only one that jumped to that very wrong conclusion upon seeing this box?
No, I had two thoughts on that. I thought at first, because of the don't look in the box and me remembering the Enemy of the Empire series where there was a living thing in the box, I went there. But then the way he said that the people are ruled over by blank with an iron fist. I thought, oh, yeah, this guy's he's part of the resistance, and he's sending him a little explosive present. It wasn't until he went down shooting to defend this box that I thought, okay, not bomb.
Actually, my thoughts went to a hostage of some reason because I was reminded of the transporter when Jason Statham's character was advised, don't look in the trunk or, you know, do you want to know what you're carrying or don't ask what you're carrying? He's like, hey, I'm the transporter. I don't care what it is. For some reason, I went to that. Don't look in the box. I don't want to look in the box. Who cares? My job's to move. I'm going to move it. I don't care what's in it. So for some reason, hostage was what I was thinking.
I thought something magical, quite honestly. I thought like Ark of the Covenant, you open it, the spirits come out in your face melt, something along those lines. When it was a person, I've kicked myself for not figuring it out because I too have seen the transporter, but I didn't go to that.
It was the gassy green form of Mother Talzin just captured in there. Let me out! Let me out! Phenomenal dark side power, itty bitty living space.
And there's our Disney reference.
So we all referenced a different movie in this scene.
Well, it is kind of a cliche, you know, the transporting some kind of captive, hostage, kidnap victim, whatever you want to call it. But I got to tell you, it just felt like it was an unusual thing here. And Asajj's reaction to it is very different than I would expect. I'm sure we'll get to that here in a little bit as we get closer to the end of the episode. But I think they made the right call here, not making it something like a bomb or some other illicit cargo, but to make it that cliche of the kidnap victim. I think it played exactly into where they needed to go for Asajj.
And as we've alluded to, yes, it is a person in the box, and she is being rescued by the Resistance, who have escaped from the latest installment in the Mortal Kombat franchise.
It's funny you say that, Dan, because I got Mortal Kombat vibe off of Boba Fett's helmet, like Cyrax or whatever those two like cybernetic ninjas were. That's what I thought that helmet looked like. So it's funny you said Mortal Kombat there.
I thought Mortal Kombat for the rest of the episode mostly, because now this is the point where the episode lost me. I was really into it for the bounty hunter stuff. I was really into it to see Asajj Ventress go with them. I still had the concerns that I mentioned before, but I was really into it. But then at this point, it's like this entire hostage plot became very obvious to me, and it was just so much action. And I guess my problem, what I'm bumping up against, is I love action, but I can't get into cartoon action. I just can't. It just very, very rarely is cartoon action exciting. The Savage Press stuff was once in a while. Clone Wars pulls it off. I actually thought last week the attack of Dathomir was exciting. But by and large, you take a bunch of people and just have them fight in a cartoon. I know before it starts who's living and who's dying and how it's going to go. And so when there are prolonged, protracted battles, I get a little checked out, and that's what started to happen to me here.
Well, see, Arnie, I was just the opposite. When the ninjas attack the train and they start having the multiple fights and all the, you know, the bounty hunters are taking these ninjas out or whatever they're called. I didn't catch the name of them, but that's when I started thinking, man, I could watch this every week. They need to spin off the further adventures of Boba, Bosk, and Dengar as the Star Wars animated series that I really actually wanted. I didn't want Clone Wars, given all the Clone Wars that's been covered over the years that I guess is now being undone. But this whole Bounty Hunter Guild, this whole Tales of the Bounty Hunter, to borrow a book title, this is a Star Wars show I'd really get behind.
Well, watch what you say, because remember, they're talking about that live-action series being very much based on the underworld and bounty hunters and such, assuming that it ever comes to exist.
I was going to say, I think we got a better shot of getting this as a spinoff than we do of ever seeing that live-action, but that's a topic for a different podcast, right?
Like Star Wars Beyond the Films at StarWarsReport.com? Oh, there's the plug we missed at the beginning. You're welcome, Dan. You're welcome. I do think that the fight scenes were carried out pretty well. I mean, I found myself engrossed in the way they were fighting. It was fast and furious. It wasn't something where it felt like the camera was always exactly on it in a nice, plain frame kind of thing. Like, oh, we can see everything in this shot. It really felt much more like you've seen a lot of action movies where the shots pick up whatever movement they can. It felt more frantic than a lot of the battles had. The only thing that kind of made me scratch my head a little bit was that Asajj doesn't start using her lightsabers, and then she pulls them out while Dengar is still there. Because at first I'm thinking maybe she's fighting hand-to-hand so as not to give away her identity. But that wouldn't really make a lot of sense because she used one in the cantina. So I'm wondering if just, you know, she didn't get to the lightsabers at first or what, but it's kind of cool to see her go hand-to-hand and then pull the lightsabers out afterward. Though you would think that the lightsabers would have caused people to, you know, step back, like, whoa, who is this that we're fighting? You would have expected some recognition on the faces, perhaps, of the enemies for what we could see, or at least in their body movements. But you don't really get that very much. I mean, you get that moment where she slashes through the different knives and such, but it seems like her reputation doesn't precede her much at this point in time. Maybe she was a little bit more of a shadow entity from the standpoint of working for Dooku in the Clone Wars than the EU made it out to be. It was a little more flashy of a character. Maybe she hasn't really been as well known in the broader scheme of things in the Clone Wars than, you know, we might have expected.
But, you know, I was kind of right there with her attackers for the most of it. I really didn't care one way or the other if she was a Force user. Up until the point where she has, they've captured the brother and the sister, and then she turns it on Boba. That was when I was kind of a little bit impressed, when she lashes out and gives Boba the squeeze.
Child abuse! Child abuse!
That poor kid, he's been in prison, he's been force choked, man.
Next thing, she'll run a lightsaber through him and kiss him first.
Hey, it's okay though, we know he turns out alright, doesn't he? Oh, wait.
I like the fact, though, that she builds that animosity with him. It would have been different if it was just, oh, Boba, just like everybody else, gets knocked off the train and she's the one left to finish the job or something like that, where there's sort of that business-based animosity going on. But it's kind of interesting here that they're setting up this rivalry between two characters we really haven't seen a rivalry between before. You know, in the EU, you've got some stuff with, you know, Aurra Sing, the other pale white lady. But now we've got Asajj Ventress in this sort of transforming role as a character herself, having Boba as a potential rival, and they even make it a little bit less of a clear-cut thing because, of course, at the end, she's going to say, you know, I'm leaving you Boba's cut, make sure he gets it. So you've got the rivalry, but at the same time, there's almost like a professional respect that she shows him as a way of undercutting, you know, any rationale he has to take vengeance on her. It's a great rivalry they're setting up here, and I didn't expect it to happen. I don't know what I expected to happen with the two of them, but I would not have expected to leave the episode rooting for Asajj and thinking, oh, Boba's going to come get you, you better be watching your back, as the feel that I got from those two interacting.
Well, you had professional respect until she offered him to the guy at the end as your new bride. I mean, tied him up in the box. I mean, that's, there's all sorts of wrong there. It's like, yeah, here's the little boy for you to play with. This is like, you know, bicycle shop, different strokes all over again.
I found that guy so funny, though. My bride! That guy had me cracking up.
He creeped me out. They got the child predator vibe going on for this guy. Way over the top. I mean, the mouth itself is weird enough with the Belugans, but, I mean, he was freaking creepy. He was creepier to me than those zombie undead things last week. I was like, ooh, getting a shiver when that guy came on screen. You know, Tua Blank, you know, child molester general or whatever he's supposed to be.
Okay, a side thought on that. A side thought on that. When the Star Wars Action News book club went through the Lando Calrissian books, which I'm sure we'll get those podcasts eventually. But when we talked them, there was a character in one of those stories, and I don't remember which one, that was described like a bird man. And I've always been intrigued because, you know, when I'm reading the book, I'm picturing, you know, literally Big Bird. And people are describing, even saying to his face, you are just the most ridiculous creature ever. So I'm imagining like a bird, like a real bird personified with just walking on the hind legs and, you know, flightless wings. So I'm always cognizant when I see different species that are bird-like. Ooh, is that it? Is that supposed to be it? Nathan, do we know anything about these species in terms of what they're supposed to? I mean, have they been around before? I mean, you mentioned their species name earlier, which I never actually caught. But is this a species we know in the Star Wars universe?
Nope. As we'll see in Continuity Corner, the Belugans are new, and their mouths are not based on birds. They're based on beluga whales, apparently.
Where's Jen when you need her?
Now, I could kind of see the whale thing, except for that their mouth kind of split into four parts, and then that was a little bit odd. But
well, it looked like a beak. I mean,
they say they reference the beluga whale thing in the concept art for the episode. And, you know, knowing that it looks like a beak, but then looking at it and saying that's not a beak, that's some other kind of thing, that even made it more creepy. You know, when a Tua Blank is at the, like, my bride, and he's like kind of almost like licking his lips over and like, creepy.
Bring me my little girl.
Wow. Just wow. So we kind of end this episode once again with Ventress by herself. And we talked about last week that at the end, all of her sisters had been killed. She was left alone and pleading on this planet, please don't leave me. And we felt like we were being drawn to feel sorry for her. But considering we've hated her for the past 3 3/4 seasons and she's just been there, they really didn't get that kind of emotion from us. And this episode, we kind of see a turning in Ventress. I'm not even going to refer back to that stinking moral. Did they manage to get a little bit of emotion toward Ventress this time around?
Well, and I think certainly what you see is the connection she has with the girl when the girl is basically just, you know, pleading about being taken away from her family and you don't know what it's like. And I think that's where she kind of, I don't know if she, that's the moment where she turns and obviously acknowledges wish I didn't.
It has to be that moment. I mean, that as soon as that moment happened, I'm like, well, again, I know where this episode is going. Visage is going to turn against the bounty hunters and make sure that this girl is freed. The only thing I didn't see Visage doing was doing that for money. But that scene, I'm sorry, it was as inobvious as a whale.
Well, and be honest with you, Arnie, I didn't know if that was the moment that turned her or if she was always there. Because it never seemed like she was really down with the fact, oh, hey, I'm delivering a hostage victim that happens to be, you know, a younger child or younger princess or whatever she is. That I don't know if she turned at that moment or if she was always there. But either way, that's where she's at. And I think that's certainly where we see a different side. I mean, Asajj Ventress from season 1 or 2 wouldn't have cared. Would have killed the brother in front of the sister, threw her back in the box and, you know, gotten her money. If she was a bounty hunter type of person, but it's definitely a growing, maturing Asajj Ventress in kind of who she wants to be.
Well, okay, let me rephrase the question then. I know that Asajj cares. Do we care? Last week, we got the feeling that they wanted us to care, but we didn't. This week, again, I kind of get the feeling they want us to care. Are we caring yet?
Here's where I care. I was impressed she did what she did in terms of the character development, so I care about where she's going. But I really like the fact that she played it out well enough to get money by double-crossing essentially Boba's, you know, the bounty that, you know, she double-crosses really Boba in a lot of ways, takes the money, which obviously she ends up giving the fair share, which kind of surprised me. But the fact that she got money for delivering the wrong captive and got money for setting them free, it's like, she was double dipping. And I was just like, man, she's cool. She's just messing everybody up.
To go to what Arnie and Jerry said about, you know, the moment where she changes, I think, you know, the decision, I was kind of going back and forth on whether it was the moment where, you know, Pluma, the little girl, is talking about her situation, if that was what pushed her over the edge, or if it was simply Boba's attitude after the fact that made her say, you know what, I'm done working for these guys. I'm going to side with the side that seems more right to me based on my own, you know, personal experience with loss and such lately. But to quote, I guess, Luke Skywalker, you know, I care. I actually found that this episode really hit home for me as we got to the end and saw Asajj changing. I mean, having her take sort of this positive turn of feeling like she actually has a future really stunned me to see here. And it probably shouldn't have, because if you look at the way that she was handled in the comics, it was handled in a somewhat similar way. She reaches a point where Anakin, during the Obsession comic, essentially cuts her down and they think she's dying. And one of her last acts is to reveal to Obi-Wan, you know, protect the core, basically warning him that an attack on Coruscant is coming. They're coming for you where you live. Do something. Protect Coruscant. And, you know, she kind of looks like she dies at that point, only to awaken on a medical ship from a healing trance, basically. And then she has the pilots basically set course to take her away from everything. Take me somewhere else to start a new life. So she essentially comes to a point where she changes her allegiance in a sense and then tries to start over again in the comics. I never would have thought they would try to place something like that in this series. And I hope she's able to continue on that path the way I expect, some stumbling blocks ahead for her. Hopefully it'll be entertaining stumbling blocks. I think that if I went back and watched the end of Massacre again now from last week, I think that the Don't Leave Me scene would finally have the empathy there. I really like the way this turned out, and I don't know if it was the animation to the facial features that really got me as far as bringing the emotional impact home, but this ending nailed it for me and made me finally say, you know what, I like this character. I will accept her now as a heroic character if that's the way they want to go. You know, continuity out the window, whatever. This works for me.
Well, Nathan, speaking of things in the continuity and how this may or may not affect or be affected by them, what else was affected or did this affect in the continuity?
Most of this episode's continuity items come in the form of new information, added information, or tweaked information about the individual bounty hunters. So we'll start with the bounty hunting team. Going hunter by hunter here. We start with the dead Oked. Oked's of the same species as the aliens on Balnab back in Nomad Droids. You know, the ones who were being duped by the god Albi Dewa that turns out to be pit droids using a hologram. He's voiced by Tom Yoda Kane. Oked himself is a new character. Lats Razi, a new character played by Claire Grant, is a Thelan, the same species as dancing girl Ristal in Return of the Jedi. Her weapon is called a grappling boa. C-21 Highsinger, the droid, also a new character and droid model, is voiced by David Accord, who has played various minor roles in the Clone Wars and was a sound editor for the prequels. Simon Pegg, known in Star Wars fandom for comments that basically claim the prequels should not exist, which makes his appearance here rather ironic and somewhat controversial, plays Dengar, whose head wraps are now said to be a turban. However, the idea that he suffers a traumatic brain injury, which might make the headgear dual purpose in the later EU, still presumably exists. Of course, that injury ties into an encounter that deals with Han Solo much, much later in the continuity, which also leads into his cybernetics. One has to wonder just how much of the Dengar we see here is cybernetic versus just armor. Daniel Logan is back, of course, as young Boba Fett, who we last saw in prison in Deception and saw in the Season 2 three-part finale. Logan has also voiced young clone cadets in ARC Troopers. Boba is shown here with new armor since his father's armor would not fit. In the original pre-2008 Clone Wars continuity, Boba's friend and one of Jabba the Hutt's cooks, Gabora Heiss, resizes Jango Fett's armor to fit Boba in the young reader book Boba Fett: A New Threat, set just 5 months before Revenge of the Sith. He was using Jango's helmet, however, earlier than that in the Boba Fett young reader series, since he can access its systems. This has led to the notion that the helmet we saw blown up in R2 Come Home was not actually Jango's helmet, but a spare or a duplicate, though that remains to be seen. Bosk is also back, voiced by D. Bradley Baker, best known for voicing the clones. We saw him in all the same episodes as Boba Fett, the three-part Season 2 finale, and Deception. Bosk's ship also appears in the episode, which presents a bit of a continuity concern. The ship is the Hound's Tooth, and is similar in design to the ship we saw in Friends and Enemies a short while ago. However, Bosk is not supposed to have the ship yet in terms of the broader continuity, as he only gets it after Han Solo and Chewbacca destroy his previous ship, which is relatively soon before A New Hope. And, well, Han and Chewie haven't met at this point, since Han's only 7 when the Clone Wars begin and 10 when they end. One has to wonder whether that event has now been removed from continuity, or if perhaps this is a different ship, also called the Hound's Tooth, and perhaps it's gone at some point, replaced by another ship or ships, and then Boss gets a new one after the encounter with Han and Chewie that he names the Hound's Tooth as a continuation of a tradition started with this ship. I guess we'll have to wait and see. Moving on past the bounty hunting team, the Belugans, based on the faces of whales, are a new species for this series. This includes the dictator, Otua Blank, voiced by Ben Diskin, whom we meet at the end, and Major Rigoso, voiced by Tom Kane, who hires the bounty hunters early in the episode. Their planet here, Corzite, is also new, created for this series. The other species on the planet is the Kaig, or Kaig Warriors, including the warrior leader Krizmo Sodhi, also voiced by Ben Diskin, and his sister, Pluma Sodhi, voiced by Meredith Salinger, who also voiced Barriss Offee, among other characters. The creature the warriors travel aboard is a Mylodon, also new for this episode. Imbo is briefly shown with his Anuba, Marok, slated to show up again in Season 5, and the cantina is presumed to be the Mos Eisley cantina, owned by Kalman, which we also saw in Sphere of Influence earlier in this series.
All right, now again, this week we are still saving your voicemails for our finale of the season, so keep on letting us know what you think, and we will get to them, we promise. But before we all say goodnight, we did get a preview for next week. Kind of an odd preview, depending on which one you saw. I kind of saw the conglomeration preview with the revealing of Darth Maul, and then the little clip where we see Savage Opress talking to the mist that is Mother Talzin, who apparently isn't dead.
Yeah, I saw the one where he's talking to his locket and looking at dusty canisters. And I'm like, all right, this is like the worst preview ever.
So next week's episode begins the two-parter that we've been looking forward to since they teased it, what, six episodes into this season? Darth Maul returns. Looking forward to that. Should be exciting. I mean, we've got Sam Witwer doing the voice of Darth Maul, as we've mentioned, which I know I'm excited about. Nathan has said he's excited because he really likes Sam's voiceover work.
I'll say this again next week, but I might as well say it now so people who are listening can just get this mindset. I don't care what they do. However they make it that Maul lived, it's going to be dumb. But if what they do with it is cool, I'm going to give it that mulligan. There's no way that they can tell me that it was not fully intended when the blood sprayed and Darth Maul's body fell in two separate directions. Maul was not intended by every single person from Lucas to everyone in the audience to be dead. If suddenly Zabrak can live cut in half, then perhaps Obi-Wan would have known that. And the fact that nobody went to look for him in the bottom of the shaft, no matter what they do, it's the mulligan you got to give it. Yeah, and I'm going to give it to it. I'm not going to hold it any grudges. I don't care if they said he fell on magic flowers that grew him new legs. I'm going to give them whatever it takes. They just better earn it.
I'm totally with you, Arnie. I don't care from a quote unquote continuity perspective or what have you, but I'm with you. That is soap opera level of, oh no, he's not really dead. He's come back to something or another. I mean, Boba Fett can fly out of the Sarlacc because he has a jetpack, and that has some like, oh, okay, I can see that because Boba Fett's really cool, and I want to see Boba Fett continue in the Star Wars folklore. But I'm with you. It's like there's no way. It'd be like bringing Qui-Gon back, you know, after getting his, you know, heartedectomy or something, you know?
See, I think it's just something in the name. Apparently, if your name is Maul and you're a Darth Side Force user and you get cut in half, you survive. Because, well, that happened to the Maul guy in the Jedi Knight video game, except for he floated it around on the magical power of hate. So at least they're not going that route with it.
Now, seeing as how they've already essentially revealed at least part of how he survived in The Wrath of Darth Maul, I'm going to leave thoughts on this one until next week. It's going to be kind of an interesting thing to see how people react, including those who have already read about how it happened once they see it happen on screen. So I'll hold off my thoughts on his bizarre, rather weird way of resurrecting himself.
All right. Well, then on that note, we will leave it, and we will see everyone back next week for episode 21, Brothers. See y'all next time.
Thank you for listening to Republic Forces Radio Network. Remember, we want your thoughts on the next episode of the Clone Wars series. You can leave us a voicemail at 415-508-JEDI every week from the time the new episode airs, and voicemails received by 1 a.m. Sunday morning may be included in our next episode. You can find our reviews of previous Clone Wars episodes, as well as our summer series reviewing the classic droid cartoon series, at our website, www.republicforces.com. And be sure to listen to our other Star Wars podcast, Star Wars Action News, covering all aspects of Star Wars collecting, from figures to high-end collectibles to Star Wars Band-Aids. Republic Forces Radio Network is hosted by Jerry, Arnie, Dan, Jen, Berent, and Nathan P. Butler of StarWarsFanWorks.com. Republic Forces Radio Network, RepublicForces.com, and Star Wars Action News are not affiliated with Lucasfilm or any other official Star Wars-related company. Star Wars and all that the Star Wars universe contains are copyright and trademarked, Lucasfilm Limited, and no infringement is intended. Republic Forces Radio Network is a Venganza Media production. Copyright 2012. All rights reserved.
But also joining us, as you may have heard, is from Star Wars Action News, Marvelicious Toys, and now playing Arnie.
Happy to be here, Dan.
I stumped him. I took all of his plugs.
Yes, you did. You took my three shows and my hair. All my plugs were gone.
Familiar. I'm wanting to say something out of Gladiator 300.
Which wasn't nearly as good as Gladiator 299.
No, I mean,
what are you talking about? What is Gladiator 300?
No, Gladiator or 300.
Oh, they had droids in Gladiator and 300 back in those historical settings somewhere.
No, his face looked similar to some of the masks out of that the gladiators wore in the movie Gladiator or something that.
I get what you're saying. Now I just sound like
you're following me now. No, not Gladiator 300.
He does his little spin around shooting trick, and I'm like, Death Blossom! And some people out there are going to be like, yep. And others are like, what are you talking about?
Nice.
I'll take the what are you talking about side of the fence.
And I'm going to advise you to go to Walmart and pick up a copy of The Last Starfighter Blu-ray DVD combo pack, and do not come back here until you've watched it.
Yeah! I just feel like I got scolded.
Dude, I'll take my
paper towels and go home.
How can you not have seen Last Starfighter? Really?
I've only seen it once.
I saw it. I didn't catch your reference.
Death Blossom is like one of three things worth remembering in that movie. The other would be the blatant Star Wars alien ripoff. But anyway.
Well, the whole damn movie is a Star Wars ripoff.
Well, yeah. All right, now again, this week we are still saving your voicemails for our finale of the season. So keep on letting us know what you think, and we will get to them, we promise.
Yeah, and sometimes the finale of the season is what we call a season finale.
Hey, Jerry, shut up.
Okay.
Don't you have some chips or something?
He's the bounty of the Darth.
I was practicing my Yoda speak.